Good evening. Boy, this is high. I want to welcome you on behalf of Lancaster Theological Seminary. My name is Annabelle Prophet. I'm acting dean of the seminary this semester. And it is my privilege to welcome you to this third in a series of three symposia that we have been conducting here at the seminary on issues of public concern. Our first symposia dealt with issues of public education, the second one with issues of violence and nonviolent alternatives, and this evening's symposium is exploring the difficulty that women face in the job market, entitled, Would You Hire This Woman? Shattering the Glass Ceiling. These symposia are part of Lancaster Theological Seminary's celebration of 100 years of this campus. I have the privilege this evening of introducing to you the moderator of the symposium, and she in turn will introduce our speaker and the panelists who will be responding to her. Our moderator is the Reverend Susan Minasian. And when I think of Susan, the first thing that comes to mind is that Susan is a dancer. She's a graduate of Virginia Commonwealth University, where she earned a degree in dance therapy. She's a 1988 graduate of Lancaster Theological Seminary, and she currently serves as an officer in our Alumni Council. Susan has graced the seminary with her gifts of dance, a lively mind, and particularly a winsome spirit. Susan is the pastor of Tabernacle United Church in Philadelphia, a congregation that is of both the Presbyterian Church and the United Church of Christ, seated on the edge of the University of Pennsylvania campus. It's a lively, active congregation that brings together the gifts and interests that match those of Susan. An interest in the intersection between the arts and religion, a lively place for theological and political debate, a church that is committed to peace and justice, and perhaps most importantly, a place of hospitality to all who enter its circle. It's a congregation that has had the wisdom to answer the question, would you hire this woman, with a resounding yes. I applaud them, and I applaud you, Susan, for the significant work that you are doing to shatter the glass ceiling that still exists for women in ministry. Susan Minasian.
I feel like I should pay her. Yeah, this is really low for me. It was not like this when I was in preaching class. Somebody's running up here. Why are you running up here? Oh, okay. I'm sure many of you have read the book or have at least heard of the book, Everything I Ever Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Well, maybe that is true for some, but not for me. Usually what we learn about the world begins before we get into kindergarten. Sometimes it is even before we take our very first step into the sandbox. We learn how we will be received and valued at a very early age. And the rules are out there, and through trial and error, we learn. Our guest this evening learned at an early age that she could do anything she wanted to do. Her parents provided her with an environment that was open. She was encouraged to dream and achieve anything. She continues to pass that liberating promise of hope to her own children today. Tonight, we are honored to hear Dr. Carol Auster as she addresses what concerns many little girls when they become women and move from sandboxes into the working world outside of the home. The question is asked, would you hire this woman? And hopefully we will get part of an answer from Dr. Carol Auster, who is currently Associate Professor of Sociology at Franklin and Marshall College. Professor Auster holds a BA from Colgate University and a master's degree and PhD from Princeton University. She has been at Franklin and Marshall since 1981 and teaches a number of courses, including sex and gender roles, and another on the sociology of work and occupations. She belongs to a number of professional associations and has recently served as second vice president at the national level of the American Association of University Professors. Her research interests include women in non-traditional professions, and she has recently received a grant from the Sloan Foundation to pursue a longitudinal study of women and men in engineering. Before I invite her to come forward, I would like to let you know about how we intend to move through this evening together. Three panelists will respond to Dr. Auster's remarks, and I will introduce them to you later in the program. And following their responses, you will have an opportunity to ask all those burning questions that you came with and that you will have after you hear them speak. I will invite you to come to the center to the mic and ask that you please speak in the mic and not just stand up and speak. So now I invite you to join me in welcoming Dr. Carol Auster.
I'd like to thank Susan for her gracious introduction and thank all of you for attending tonight's symposium. I also want to thank President Schmeeker, who invited me to be a part of this 100th anniversary celebration, and also Carnine Carnock-Burkeen, who made a lot of the arrangements. It's an honor and pleasure to be here. When social scientists are asked to talk about dramatic changes in the workforce in the last several decades or even the last decade, there are four changes that typically come to mind. The first is the shift in our society from having a majority of workers employed in the manufacturing sector to having a majority of workers employed in the service sector, meaning education, insurance, sales, etc. The second is the dramatic impact that technology is having on the workplace. The third important change is the expansion of what has come to be known as the global economy. But it is, of course, the fourth change, and perhaps the most important change, which is of greatest interest to us tonight. This is the increasing role of women in the workforce. We know from the moment that babies are born, gender is an important differentiator. After all, what is usually the first sentence out of a doctor's mouth? It's a girl or it's a boy. If you try to buy a present for a friend and go to a store and look as though you were looking for a present, the first thing the store clerk will ask you is it a boy or a girl that you're looking for a gift for? Buying books seems to be a good way out of answering that question. An oversimplification of gender stereotypes would be that boys and men are supposed to be independent, assertive, and strong, while girls and women are expected to be nurturing, supportive, and emotional. That's certainly an oversimplification. All six of these traits are certainly valuable in their own right. But tonight I will talk about how gender stereotypes affect a variety of aspects of work and how they cause some difficulties for women. First, we will look at the impact of gender role stereotypes at the societal level by examining their impact on the occupational structure. Second, we will look at the impact of gender stereotypes at the organizational level, exploring a number of aspects of the glass ceiling. Third, we will consider the interrelation between work and family. And finally, I will tell you what I think we need to do to resolve some of these problems. Some overall statistics, and you all should have a handout with some labor force statistics in front of you. If you look at these statistics, which come from the Statistical Abstract of the United States and are based on numbers from the U.S. Department of Labor, the way to read this table, and if I can just give you a brief example of that, if you move over to the far right column and see 1992, under that it says 64.7. What that means is of single women 16 years and older, 64.7% of them were in the workforce in 1992. So that's how to read all of the numbers in this table. I've given you lots of numbers which you can pore over all night all next week. Let me just briefly tell you what I see when I look at these numbers. The dramatic changes that have occurred is that there are more women in the workforce than ever before, and the most dramatic changes have occurred for married women and married women with children. In fact, if you look at the statistics for divorced women, which are the bottom three categories, you can see that actually there's been very little change in the last 20 years or so. Divorced women have participated in the workforce at a rate which is nearly comparable to men. If you look at the very bottom here, where it says 1992, we currently have 57.8 million women in the workforce, 69.2 million men, and that means that 57.8% of women were in the workforce and 75.6% of men were in the workforce. So you can see that the 75.6 is not that different from what's happening with divorced women. Another figure that's very striking to me has to do with married women with children under six, and specifically with children one and under. In 1992, 56.7% of married women with children 1 year and under were in the labor force. And although I don't have statistics available for the other years, I can tell you that I know that's dramatically different from 10 years before or even 20 years before. Since there are a large number of women and men with children in the workforce, one of the things that means is that children need care. And of course, because the number of children in single-parent households is increasing, that also raises issues of child care, which I will come back to later. Suffice it to say, from looking at this table, there have been some dramatic changes in the workforce related to women, and it has mostly meant a dramatic increase in the percent of women in the workforce. Although the percent of women in the workforce has increased dramatically, the following anecdote illustrates another aspect of the work world. I used to tell this at the beginning of my sex and gender class. In fact, I still do. But the response has changed over time. A father and son were driving one dark night when they were in a terrible accident. The father was killed. The son rushed to the hospital emergency room. A middle-aged surgeon in a white coat walks into the emergency room, sees the boy, and says, "Oh my God, my son." The question is, who is the surgeon? In the early 80s, when I began teaching a sex and gender course and using this anecdote, students mentioned stepfather, uncle, grandfather, secret father, and began to create fantasies from soap operas about who the man could be that might be associated with this young boy. In more recent years, my students very quickly realized that the person who says, "Oh my God, my son," is the boy's mother. Despite the recognition that the surgeon was the boy's mother, two additional things need to be said about the U.S. occupational structure. On the one hand, it remains largely sex segregated. That is, many occupations are still statistically dominated by one sex, male dominated or female dominated. If you flip to table two, I've given you some examples of that. You can see if you look at occupations like secretary, dental hygienist, child care worker, registered nurse, the percent of those in each occupation which are women is still over 94% in all of them, and the percent of men in each of those occupations is really very small. I've provided you with statistics about teachers because you can see that as the level gets higher, the percent of men increases. The bottom six or seven occupations I've chosen because they are some of the examples of the occupations statistically dominated by men. So one of the things we see then is that although there's been a dramatic increase of women in the workforce, many occupations remain largely sex segregated. Some have referred to some of these occupations in which women predominate not as white collar or blue collar work, but rather pink collar, making the reference to the fact that they are statistically dominated by women. If women are supposed to be, by stereotypes, nurturing and supportive, it is not surprising that a field like nursing is dominated by women. Even though the reality is, for example, that nurses need to be physically strong to lift patients, think analytically to care about the condition of their patients, there's still the thought that somehow are the gender stereotypes and the stereotype of the occupation fit together. In addition, we should realize that these are culturally created. Some of the particular occupations which are male-dominated in the U.S. are very different elsewhere. For example, to be a physician in the former Soviet Union is not unusual for a woman. In fact, 75% of physicians are women. They do the same job that physicians do in the United States. There is an interesting point, though, which is that being a physician is much less prestigious in the former Soviet Union than it is in the United States. On the other hand, in many occupations, women and men are making lots of inroads into occupations previously dominated by the other sex. It is interesting, however, that a lot of the women making inroads early on tended to find themselves in still what I would say as female-identified or, you know, certain kinds of specialties. For example, a lot of the early women physicians, as they entered medicine, found themselves in what I call the three Ps. Pediatrics, again, you can see the obvious connection. Psychiatry. Public health is a bit different, but that's because of the hours. Similarly, in law, women were much more likely to be found in family or estate law, and again, I think you can see the connection. Lots of people talk about women gravitating towards these specialties, and I never quite know what gravitate means. On the one hand, it could mean that women actually and freely prefer these fields, and I think we would all feel very comfortable with that. At the other end of the spectrum, gravitate could mean that the gatekeepers of those specialties decide whether women will be in or out. They may not let them in, they could push them away, or perhaps not be supportive of them. And in some female-dominated fields, it is interesting to note something like teaching, nursing, or library work, that women are underrepresented as library administrators, nursing administrators, and as principals. One statistic I find particularly encouraging is the number of women currently receiving degrees in particular fields. And if you flip to the third page, I've given you some examples of that. Table 3 is the percent of bachelor's degrees earned by women. So in 1971, for example, you have less than 1% of bachelor's degrees in engineering being awarded to women. By 1990, it's 13.8. Certainly in business and management, we've seen a more dramatic jump. And again, you can look at these statistics in detail later on. But you can see as you look at these fields that these fields, which have been highly male-dominated, they are still male-dominated in 1990, but certainly women have made a lot of inroads. Secondly, if you look at Table 4, these are professional degrees, percent of women receiving professional degrees, not simply bachelor's degrees, and I have data from 1970, 1980, and 1990. And you can see again that, for example, in dentistry, we've gone from less than 1% of degrees awarded in dentistry being awarded to women in 1970 to nearly a third by 1990. And again, we see similar patterns with, I think, probably law being one of the most striking, going from 5% in 1970 to 42.2% by 1990. So those are some of the things that encourage me because we've seen so many changes. So I guess what I find discouraging is this sex segregation is still so strong. On the other hand, I find it encouraging that women and, to a lesser extent, but men are making some inroads into the female-dominated occupations, too. I also find the innocent questions of the young encouraging. This past September, my two daughters, Lauren and Lisa, and I had planned a trip to Toronto to visit my sister. Several weeks before we were taking the trip, I'd explained that we would be flying in a plane, we wouldn't be driving in the car. And they had asked whether I would be driving the plane, and I explained that no, a pilot would in fact be, quote, driving the plane. And so for about 2 weeks before we went, Lauren and Lisa would practice packing things up, getting ready for the trip, pretend that they were the pilot. One would be the pilot, one would be the passenger, or they both would be pilots. So when we were filing on the plane, I remembered as a child, actually even as an adult, being very excited to go up and look at the cockpit and ask them whether they would like to do that. So we walked up front. And they are, I guess they were 2.5 and 4.5 at the time, and their eyes were about as wide open as I could imagine, and I thought they're looking at the instruments and the panels, and very quickly one of them turned to me and said, "Why are they men?" And what I realized was that they had asked me whether I would be the driver of the plane, and they, as girls, had spent the last 2 weeks being pilots. And it simply had never crossed their mind that even though, and I looked up the statistic the other day, that even though less than 4% of airline pilots are in fact women, it had never crossed their mind that that was an occupation that was male-dominated. For the next few minutes, I want to move from talking about how gender stereotypes affect the labor force at the societal level to talking about how gender stereotypes affect the labor force at an organizational level. Whether based on employers or supervisors' overt hostility or not, it is clear that gender stereotypes play into women's difficulties. I'd like to start with a few statistics. In 1990, only 19 fewer than 1% of the approximately 400 highest-paid officers and directors in top companies were women. Within the Fortune 500 companies, women and minorities hold fewer than 5% of the senior management posts. A so-called glass ceiling is said to block the on-the-job mobility of women of all social classes, as well as minorities of both sexes. Indeed, in some organizations, the glass ceiling may be so low that one sociologist, Catherine Bearhide, has come to call it not the glass ceiling, but the sticky floor, with the implication that you can't even get your feet up. You have no chance even to reach the glass ceiling. Historically, African-American women and men have fared worse in promotions than other groups. And one African-American woman I know described the situation not as a glass ceiling, but as a cement ceiling, which I think, again, gives us some imagery that's helpful. In recent years, one of the dominant explanations for women's inability to penetrate the upper levels of the corporate world has been called the glass ceiling. The glass ceiling, as many have defined it, is a transparent or invisible barrier that prohibits women from rising above certain levels in an organization. Although the glass ceiling is a powerful and descriptive metaphor that aptly summarizes the experience of many women, a sociologist on the Faculty of Administrative Studies at York University in Toronto, Canada, who has looked at this carefully, suggests that the notion of a glass ceiling may be misleading. The sociologist just happens to be the sister that we were flying to see in Toronto. She points out first that the glass ceiling is really not one ceiling or a wall in one spot. It occurs all the time and takes many forms. Although it may occur more frequently as you get closer to the top, it is always there. It can be intentional, it can be unintentional, it can be conscious or unconscious, but it is caused by the gender stereotypes that I mentioned before. Gender bias means that it is not what women do or do not do on the job that affects their progress in organizations, but how their on-the-job performance is perceived, reacted to, or acted upon. Another aspect of the glass ceiling, which may mean that it's not quite as good a metaphor as we all believe, is that the glass ceiling is not transparent. I think we have this notion, the idea of a glass ceiling was that you couldn't see it and that suddenly you came up against it. But it's not transparent. It is visible and apparent, particularly to those who experience it. The idea of glass implies it's transparent and cannot be seen, and although the focus here is on gender bias, certainly many of the issues are also relevant to biases based on any characteristics of otherness, ethnicity, age, or race. If I go back now for a moment to the cement ceiling, I think the description of the cement ceiling may more aptly describe it in that you can see it and it's there. I suppose part of the question we're asking is, can you then break through what could be concrete, or is it really something that is shatterable, something more like glass? Many aspects of organizational dynamics leave room for gender stereotypes, gender bias, and thus mechanisms related to the glass ceiling can creep in easily. First, there's the recruitment and selection process. Gender bias can creep in there. How can it creep in? Well, it may be that the decisions, even about how to describe the job opening, may be more appealing either to men or to women. Where, how, and when it's advertised, who does the recruiting, who does the sorting from the preliminary interviews, all of that may be a place where gender bias can creep in. Common sources of bias include defining jobs in ways that are less likely to attract women, relying on informal networking as a primary means of finding job candidates, and it may be that that doesn't plug into potential women job candidates, or closure in an early screening process so that candidates from outside the organization or outside the network might not even have a chance to apply in time. Organizational characteristics or occupational characteristics, such as the percent of each sex in the occupation, may also have an impact on the perceived value of each sex's contribution. In her book, Men and Women of the Corporation, Rosabeth Cantor writes about Indusco, which is a very large corporation. One observation of hers is particularly relevant here. At this particular company, the middle management level was mostly white and male. And one of the things she found in looking at the company is that over and over again in their recruitment and final selection process is that although they did not perceive it as bias, they kept selecting people like themselves. When asked something about the people they selected, they would say, "It's someone I felt comfortable with. It's someone I felt familiar with." And I think what actually was happening, according to her, is that they were feeling most comfortable with someone who was very much like themselves in terms of characteristics. She refers to this notion of hiring someone like yourself as homosocial reproduction. And I think because of that, in the recruitment phase, you can often have people repeating themselves, repeating who they are. A second place that gender stereotypes and gender bias can creep in is in task assignment, the process by which managers may decide who gets to do particular tasks in a company. Entire divisions of a company may be sex segregated. Some have referred to that as the glass wall because you can't get through it this way. Women may be assigned less challenging tasks or clients, again, on some assumption that the women have lower aspirations. Did anyone ask the women whether they had lower aspirations? No. A third place where gender bias can creep in and the gender stereotypes can have an impact is performance appraisal. A lot of studies have shown that where the criteria of performance are vague and the measures unclear, that is the situation in which gender bias is most likely to creep in. If the appraisers are not well trained or the evidence associated with the appraisal is based on recollection and opinion rather than documented files, letters, or feedback, gender bias, whether intentional or not, may creep in. Also, when a number of people work together on a project, it may be that unless someone makes files now that explains who contributed what, that later on when someone's going through a performance appraisal, people may forget who contributed what, and gender stereotypes may imply somehow that the woman did not do the great things that she had actually done. And if the performance appraisals of women are lower, then of course that contributes to the wage gap, which we all know about so well. Likewise, in the promotion process, if we think the performance appraisals then lead to promotions or not, if gender bias is creeping in there, we're going to have the same trouble with women not getting the kinds of promotions that they should. Rosabeth Cantor also discusses the dynamics of majority token situations, and I feel her discussion is relevant to our concerns about gender bias in task assignments and performance appraisal. She writes about skewed groups, which she refers to as groups in which there are 85% of one group and 15% of another. So for our purposes now, let's think of it as 85% men and 15% women. She says the dynamics change when you have that few of any category in a particular group. At Indisco, she points out that women in upper management find themselves experiencing performance pressures from life in the limelight. As a token, they are noticeable. They are paraded in front of clients and cannot afford to do anything wrong because the spotlight is on them. A second thing that happens is boundary heightening. The presence of only a few tokens seems to make the dominance all the more aware of the token presence. At Indisco around token women, there were sometimes exaggerated displays of aggression and potency, incidences of sexual innuendos, prowess-oriented war stories, interrupters as reminder of difference, people saying, oh, can't tell that joke here, reminding the woman that she was not part of their group. And third, something which Cantor calls role encapsulation. The women at Indisco seem to get cast into one of four stereotyped roles. The mother, the one the men told their private troubles to and expected to be comforted by, which again doesn't lead you to continue up the promotion hierarchy. The seductress, and in that case, the powerful men tried to act as protectors and tried to keep the other men away. The pet, where you take them along to meetings and say, look, we have a woman, and that she's supposed to sit there and admire the male displays. And interestingly enough, the fourth category was the Iron Maiden, the one who would not let herself be molded into the other three. Women or other tokens are then left to balance on tightropes, hoping not to lean too far one way or the other. First, there is the trait tightrope. The image of an ambitious man is clear, less so for women. Second, the verbal tightrope. Deborah Tannen, in her best-selling book, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, shows how the very same message connotes very different reactions depending on who is sending the message and who is receiving the message. If the boss is male and the subordinate is male, and the boss says, have this on my desk by the end of the day, that may be perceived as perfectly fine. While for that same male subordinate, a woman making that same statement might seem too demanding. So it's the same communication, but perceived differently. In addition, since men are less likely to produce listener noise, the that women often engage in, women often think men are not listening, when in fact they are. And on the other hand, sometimes when men are talking and women are engaging in their listener noise, men just want to say, can you just be quiet so I can talk? When in fact, the woman is trying to say, I'm listening to you with the et cetera. Anyway, so Verbal tightropes, figuring out where to balance, is another tightrope that women walk. A third tightrope is what some call the appearance tightrope. Trying to figure out somehow a way to find a balance in dress and appearance between authority and femininity, and trying to get a sense of what people around her think of various ways of trying to do that. The fourth tightrope is the work and family tightrope, somehow or other balancing work and family, which brings me to the next topic. Several years ago, there was a lot of discussion of a possible mommy track at top law firms. The idea behind it was that women who chose to do so could have careers that did not require as much of them as those who would decide to pursue career tracks which would make them, quote, partner material. The downside, of course, was that these women would not expect to be either promoted or compensated the same way as those who follow the fast track. Although the idea was criticized for many reasons, including the idea that this was a lower prestige track and one thought to be predominantly occupied by women, as indicated by the name, I thought that one thing this idea did point to was the necessity of the workplace having to accommodate to family, having to accommodate not only to women but to men. People may want to have careers and also be very involved in their children's lives. One clue that we get about this, about both men and women wanting to be involved in their children's lives, is because of some of the things that men talk about when they have midlife crises. Sometimes, even at the peak of their career, men will lament the fact that they have not spent more time with their children. Other men talk about the fact that although their wife is able to leave 2 hours early because the child is sick, that they really do not feel that they can do that. And of course, for some women, this is true too. Interestingly, our society has paid much more attention to both men and women being in the workforce now that it's dual-collar professional couples. But in fact, blue-collar families have had both parents in the workforce for decades. The difference is that in many of these blue-collar families, people in extended families lived near one another. And what that meant is that relatives were those who could take on the child care. Or it might mean, in the case of blue-collar work, that he and she could work different shifts. It might be that all they do is he works a shift, she works a shift, and they both sleep and never get to speak to each other, but they at least knew children were taken care of. But in this age of high geographic mobility, many people live very far from their extended family, or their extended family may not wish to engage in that kind of child care. Moreover, we all know of the increasing number of single-parent families. All of these trends point to the need for affordable, accessible, high-quality daycare for children. In fact, compared to other industrialized nations, the United States is notably lacking in high-quality care that is accessible to all, and also notably lacking in paid maternity and paternity leaves. Many institutions need to become involved in family care if we are to have work and family meshed together in a manageable way. Businesses need to care more about family, and if for no other reason, we should encourage them to care because any negative influences from the family can have a negative impact on work, which can ultimately have a negative impact on profit. That's not a nice way to put it, but there may be some businesses that need to be told that way. I also think the government needs to contribute more resources to these needs. Flex time, flex place where you do your work, on-site daycare, financial assistance for child care, extended maternity and paternity leave, and elder care would all help. We also need to change our values such that using such programs does not interfere with others' assumptions about an individual's commitment to work. One of the concerns that women and men, too, have had is if they take a long paternity leave, whatever it is, what will their company or whatever think of them? I've suggested some remedies needed to resolve some of the conflicts between work and family, and of course, we didn't have these conflicts when work and family were all in the same place. When we were an agricultural society, work and family was all in the one place. No one said, oh, we're going to different places in the morning, what will we do with our children? It was all done in the same location, and it's the fact that we started moving work away from home that has left us with the dilemmas that we have now. At the organizational level, it seems that the impact of gender stereotypes are greatest when the process is subjective. Replacing informal recruitment and promotion criteria and practices with formal ones should help, which also means that if you're in that position, you need to document everything you're doing so when a performance appraisal comes at the end of a year, you have a factual list of what, in fact, you have achieved rather than leaving it to the recollections of others. Second, pursuing litigation and legislative changes is important. A 1991 court case led the Marriott Corporation to pay $3 million to women managers who had been denied promotions. At fault was the company's informal promotion policy and a work culture that froze women out. A legislative example is, and the title I think is actually interesting, is the Glass Ceiling Division within the U.S. Department of Labor, which was established by Congress in 1991. It's supposed to look at eliminating barriers to women's and minorities' promotions to top posts. That the Glass Ceiling Division and the success of that, of course, depends on two things. One, of willingness of aggrieved parties to come forward, and secondly, the willingness of enforcement agencies to enforce, and we'll have to see what happens with that. In a moment, my suggestions for what else to do, particularly at the societal level, will become evident. One sociologist, Lucille Duberman, says, neither sex should be maneuvered into a position that is predetermined and contrary to individual preferences and talents. All of us should be free to select the lifestyles that enlarge our horizons and grant us contentment as individuals. Although I have certainly implied that my husband and I try to assure that our daughters see many occupational options, I think we would probably discourage interest in certain kinds of occupations. Hired gun, car thief, drug lord. So we're not as open as we appear. We do actually have limits. I also want you to know from things I've said, I'm certainly not advocating abolishing all those traits that we think of femininity or masculinity. More of what I'm talking about here is letting people develop in the way that they are rather than channeling them, in some cases, into something that's unnatural for them. In Sex and Temperament in Three Primitive Societies, Margaret Mead, a famous anthropologist, says, historically, our own culture has relied for the creation of rich and contrasting values upon many artificial distinctions, the most striking of which is sex. It will not be by the mere abolition of these distinctions that society will develop patterns in which individual gifts are given a place instead of being forced into an ill-fitting mold. If we are to achieve a richer culture, rich in contrasting values, we must recognize the whole gamut of human potentialities and so weave a less arbitrary social fabric, one in which each diverse human gift will find a fitting place. Today, sex stereotypes and traditional attitudes coexist alongside new emerging patterns. Whether the old beliefs will change even more profoundly in the near future, or whether we will stand still for a while to evaluate the recent changes, will reflect the capacity and desire of our society to change some of its values and power structures. What was regarded as an unalterable part of the natural order is now recognized as a social creation, and therefore is something that we can fashion in accordance with our present and future values. As Peter Berger, a sociologist, says in his book Invitation to Sociology, unlike the puppets, we have the possibility of stopping in our movements, looking up, and perceiving the machinery by which we have been moved. In this act lies the first step towards freedom. Once we understand how society works, how lives are shaped, we make our own decisions about whether to maintain things as they are or change them. What do you want? How much will you risk? There is nothing less at stake here than the happiness and effectiveness of human beings. Just as society creates us, we have a hand in creating society. It is the task for each of us to decide what our society is to be comprised of. As Eleanor Holmes Norton, an African American woman, said when she was New York City's commissioner on human rights, she said, "What is a woman? A woman is a person who makes choices. A woman is a dreamer. A woman is a planner. A woman is a maker and a molder. A woman is a person who makes choices. A woman builds bridges. A woman makes children and makes cars. A woman writes poetry and songs. A woman is a person who makes choices." And certainly I think you could interject man throughout that whole thing, which would give you a man makes children and makes cars, a man writes poetry and songs, a man is a person who makes choices. Although these many choices may make the choice process more confusing than it was for the women of the 1950s, it does mean one can sincerely seek a life which will blend one's interests and dreams so that the outcome is making life choices which are closely matched to one's interests and talents. I believe that would lead to happier and more satisfied women and men. As you can tell from some of my previous comments, I feel that socialization plays a very important role in women's and men's lives, and that socialization shapes young girls and boys, and that's where the hope for the future rests. Although the focus here has been on women and girls, we do need to remember that it is the young boys of today who may well be the recruiters of tomorrow and the fathers of children. And I think we can't forget that we need to think about them too and socialize the young men and boys to the changing roles of the 90s. Because of my belief that socialization plays a tremendous role in the development of children, I would like to end with a quote from an advocate of non-sexist child rearing who recognizes that gender may be an important component in one's social, romantic, or even sexual life, but who feels that gender is irrelevant to the educational and occupational potential of an individual. Since she feels we overemphasize the division of the sexes in the classroom, she says that she would greet her students in the following way. Good morning, tall people and short people. Good morning, children of every racial, economic, and ethnic background. Good morning, talented dancers and athletes, and budding writers and scientists, musicians and magicians, carpenters and clowns. Good morning, firstborns, middle children, youngest and oldest, only children, adopted children, orphans, and twins. She says she would never begin with, good morning, boys and girls. Thank you.
That was great. Thank you. We have three panelists to bring before you this evening that will respond. Our first panelist is Earl Hess. Earl, if you'll come forward. Earl is founder and president of Lancaster Laboratories and has seen his company grow over 33 years from a one-room lab into an organization with more than 475 employees. Today, Lancaster Laboratories provides analytical research and development as well as consulting services in the environmental, food, and pharmaceutical sciences to clients all over the world. Dr. Hess is a Bachelor of Science graduate in chemistry from Franklin and Marshall College and has a PhD degree in organic and biochemistry from the University of Illinois. Throughout his career, Dr. Hess has served with distinction as a scientist, entrepreneur, and community leader. He was chair of the Pennsylvania delegation to the 1986 White House Conference on Small Business, president of the American Council of Independent Laboratories, and chair of the Lancaster Chamber of Commerce and Industry. This year, he will complete a six-year term as the director of the United States Chamber of Commerce. In 1988, Dr. Hess was named Business Leader of the Year by the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry. Welcome. This person I know, and it's great that she is now in the Lancaster area, the Reverend Karen Elizabeth King. She is one of three area conference ministers in the Penn Central Conference of the United Church of Christ. She is located in Lancaster, and her area of responsibility includes the 91 congregations of the Gettysburg, York, and Lancaster Associations of the United Church of Christ. She has served as area conference minister since September 1993. A graduate of Boston University College of Liberal Arts, Reverend King received a Master of Divinity degree from Andover Newton Theological School. That's okay, Karen. And is currently completing a Doctor of Ministry at Eden Theological Seminary. From 1987 until last September, she served Emmanuel United Church of Christ in Kissimmee, Florida, a congregation for which she was founding pastor and organizing minister. I know Karen because we both serve on the United Church Board for World Ministries, and she is a wonderful vice president of that corporation. Welcome. Last but not least, Madeline Nix, an attorney with the Lancaster law firm of Hartman, Underhill, and Brubaker. Madeline Nix is originally from Atlanta, Georgia, another great Southerner. one of 10 African-American students who participated in the desegregation of the Atlanta public school system. From 1974 to 1991, she was an attorney for Ford New Holland Incorporated. And from 1985 to 1987, she accepted additional responsibilities as an Equal Employment Opportunity Programs Manager. In 1978, Ms. Nix was named Pennsylvania Woman of the Year, and in 1982, she was designated a Woman of Achievement by Soroptimus International. A BA graduate of Spelman College, Ms. Nix earned a JD in General Trial Practice and Labor Relations at Emory University Law School. She has an MBA in Business Administration from Fordham University Graduate School of Business. Ms. Nix is a member of the Pennsylvania and Georgia Bar Associations. She is a past vice president of Soroptimus International of Lancaster and currently serves on the boards of the American Cancer Society, Lancaster County Library, and the Cultural Council of Lancaster County. Welcome. Our panelists will now share with us.
I guess since I'm alphabetically first, I will go first. Let me say, first of all, I could say, jokingly say, I feel like the token male here, but I don't feel that way at all. I'm really honored to be invited into this subject because of my interest in it, and I think some of the contributions that our company has made toward it. We're not going to talk in this panel as fast as your speaker did. We were not given any advance copy of her text, and yet we were told to respond rather than make our own speeches. So my job here is to take a whole host of scribbling and try to find some sort of response. But there are a couple of things that Carol said that really struck a tender nerve with me. And I don't want to talk about my own company and what we've done. You've gotten a little background in my introduction, but I wanted to say that something you can pick up as you leave if you want is a little public relations piece entitled An Overview of Lancaster Laboratories, which gives a little bit of our history, who we serve, a copy of our mission statement and also our values statement, which I think you might find of interest. The whole question of women in the workplace. Franklin Marshall, it was an all-male school, but even when I got to graduate school, I found that there were very few women in chemistry. For some reason or other, possibly because there were not career opportunities, for what reason, I don't know. But by the time I was in business and beginning to employ, there were quite a number of very capable, professional young women ready to be hired. And I think whether you do it for altruistic reasons or whether you do it for business reasons, anybody who is stupid enough to deny himself access to half of possible employees is really kind of crazy. Something else that Carol said, and this is kind of rambling, but she talked about the agrarian society and how when people were on the farm, there wasn't this conflict of a husband-wife combination being able to work together without the child-bearing or the child-caring concerns. I grew up in such a family farm where my mother helped in the field and my father helped with some household duties. But the question of what do we do with the kids was never a prevalent one. When we had our family, my wife, who is very definitely a co-founder of our business, was there as a right-hand, almost said right-hand man to me, but a right-hand partner, doing all the support things that I needed to do, needed to have done and couldn't possibly afford to have done. And we had children, but it was so small that practically nobody came into the place, and our youngest spent much of her time on a blanket or in a playpen playing right behind the secretary receptionist's desk. And so there was never really a problem of how she could incorporate her work life because of family responsibilities. When it was about 1985 or so, when we started to hear that our large population of younger females, or we began to sense that what's going to happen as they anticipate childbearing and would want to stay on as professionals. We made a survey of what was about 60% female employment at that time, average age 32. It doesn't take much common sense to add that up, and found out that most of them would very much like to continue their career uninterrupted, and also would like to be a part begin a family. And so we did a crazy thing of starting an on-site child care center, capacity about 30 children, I think. We started out with five, and in less than a year's time, we had the place full. We've gone to a center that held 110, and now one holds 150, plus slots for about 25 adults. And it is full, not all of employees, but the community people. And what I've seen develop since that time is that young, capable professionals have been able to stay in their careers and have moved into senior positions, whether they're in management or in senior technical positions, without that interruption in career. Business statistics. Our industry is a rapid turnover industry, average of like 27% per year. Our turnover rate is 7.3, I think. We now have young women that have been there long enough and continuous enough that they qualify for management positions. And as of last year, we passed the 50% mark of women in the management levels. Now, at our senior management level, we have one out of three. And I think with time, we can see many women that are on this career track coming into really responsible positions at that level. One last comment. I'd like to play on this term glass ceiling. I have found that women bring to our workforce that warmth. We sometimes joke about it, the warm fuzzies, whereas the men are numbers dominated and so on. But they bring into our culture something that I like extremely well. Our human resource department is 7 women and 2 men. So the danger of men recruiting and biasing that way is not there. Sometimes we joke about being the other way. But whether it's in the workforce, in a non-management role, or whether it's in management, the idea that women are naturally of a more caring, less confrontive nature, and I don't classify all of them that way. I've got some problem women. I've also have some very warm-hearted men. But we have a blend that I think gives a human, broad-based personality to our company that I would never want to give up. It was strange. About a couple years ago, we're in a seminar, and I was about the time I was announcing the fact that I was going to be gradually retiring from the company. And some young employees raised the question of what is it that Earl has brought to the company we will lose when he leaves if we don't identify it and preserve it. And out of that seminar came the formation of a kind of a task force or committee I've never heard of in another company. It's called our Corporate Culture Task Force. And we asked for volunteers, and I think we have 6 or 7 women and 3 men on that. And I'd just love to get together with that group to talk about the more basic and fundamental issues of what we are now, how that can be preserved, and their commitment to do that sort of thing. So, Carol, when you get into performance appraisal, male domination of recruitment and so on, I know what you're talking about out there in the other world, but I don't know what you're talking about if I apply it to Lancaster Labs. I better stop now. I think I would have done my stuff.
It certainly is a joy and a pleasure for me to be a part of this panel of respondents to this particular issue, because I have not only been an individual who has faced some of those very issues you've identified in the terms of the workplace, but also now in my current position, have an opportunity to work with both women and men in relationship to how we place clergy in local congregations. I guess I want to call attention to the statistics that Carol placed before you and note in some senses that the theological / clergy statistics are among the bleakest in terms of the growth process that you've identified through 70 to 90. And I think there's some very clear reasons for that. Unlike areas of dentistry, law, and medicine, particularly placement of clergy is tied up with other kinds of issues that are not easily remedied by the court system or by legislation that is possible for other areas of employment. I want to share with you a few statistics, particularly as they relate to the United Church of Christ nationally and the Penn Central Conference. In the United Church of Christ, we have 6,264 congregations. Of those congregations, we have 8 women who are senior pastors of churches of 500 or more members. Of those churches that are 250 members or more that are multiple staff churches, we have women who pastor 10 of those churches. In both instances, that is less than 1% of all the churches. There are 730 churches above 500 members. There are 927 churches that are above 250 members that have multiple staff. A total of 18 women in leadership roles in local churches of that size. That comes from a denomination who has been ordaining women since 1853. We have come a long way. There is yet a long way to go. Another statistic I would like to share with you relates to the situation in Penn Central Conference. We have 291 congregations within the confines of Penn Central Conference. We have in that conference a total of 428 ordained women within the conference. Of that total, 19 of them are serving in local churches out of 428 ordained women within the Penn Central Conference. Share a little piece of sort of personal history. I graduated from Andover Newton in 1981. And did not immediately pursue a position in ordained ministry. When I began searching in 1982, it took me 2 years and leaving Massachusetts to find a call to a local church. Those of you who think that placement of women clergy in Massachusetts is a matter of course, it wasn't a matter of course then. I think some of the issues that Carol identified are very, very much alive and active in the life of local churches. Some of them in some very clear and direct ways, some of them less clear and harder to get a handle on. For example, one of the things that I say to search committees as I try to open up to them the possibility of looking at all of the candidates, and I agree with you that any church that is looking for clergy and is unwilling to consider women certainly is not considering a pool of some of the most qualified candidates. In 1992 to 93, 61% of all MDiv candidates and all UCC-related seminaries were women. But one of the things I say to folks is that you need to understand that one of the dynamics that is subconsciously operating in congregations has to do with the image of pastor. There's a pastoral role of image of pastor. There's also that male role that many of us have grown up with. And for many women, particularly those who are widowed and no longer have significant men in their life, the male pastor remains probably one of their only significant male contacts in their life. And so to think about losing that male contact too, when there have been many other losses in their life, is very problematic for some. My answer is, well, not don't hire women. My answer is we need, as the church, to strengthen the role of men in worship life, in pastoral care, from the laity standpoint, so there are multiple roles of strong men in churches that nurture the women in churches, so that the only role that is nurturing for women who are in need of that role for men is not the pastor, so that we open it up in a much broader kind of picture. When you mentioned the glass ceiling, Carol, I could only think of the stained glass ceiling. The stained glass ceiling is not invisible, it is very visible. The stained glass ceiling has the weight of history and tradition wrapped up with it, and the thought of breaking that stained glass is very, very difficult. When I sought my next position after being the founding pastor at Emmanuel, I could not break through the stained glass ceiling of churches of 500 members and above. I could not secure an interview. The route that many of the women in our denomination go is the route that you see me sitting in, and this is not a second choice for me. This was clearly a call, because I can assure you, my friends, I had no intentions of coming to Pennsylvania. I also had no intentions of going to Florida either, so be careful where you say you're not going to go. And that's one of the dynamics in church life that gets tied up in a different kind of way than in traditional employment. We're not just hiring for a job, we're listening to a call. And that is a much more difficult thing to nail down than it is for specific employment, where you can draw the parameters of geography or other kinds of parameters much more clearly. The other dynamic in relationship to leadership in the church has to do with the dynamic of conference ministers. We have 39 conferences within the United Church of Christ. Of those 39, three of them are conferences that are led by women. Now, the traditional route for becoming a conference minister is you are a conference minister. Well, if there are only three women who are conference ministers, that's not a large pool from which to pick. The second route is area conference ministers, and we have more women who are in an area conference minister role. But the third route is pastors from churches of 500 members or above. So one of the three pools from which we pick is a pool that's fairly limited. Another one of the dynamics in terms of women in the ministry in relationship to placement issues is that that kind of token issue that you talk about. Many times a church will do the woman thing, and they did it, so it's out of the way, and their next pastor can be a man again. Those churches that hire the second woman are pretty courageous. I don't think there are very many churches who have hired, called three women in a row. That is very rare in our tradition. Sometimes the second woman is set up because she's not like the first woman, and the church really liked that first woman pastor, and when you, the second woman following that first woman, aren't the same kind of woman pastor, well, then we know women really aren't cut out to be pastors. And another dynamic has to do with a kind of leadership style, the consensus style of leadership versus the more control-oriented style of leadership. When women often use the consensus model of leadership in ministry, they're often perceived as weak and insecure. And then when they use the control style of leadership, they're also often perceived as being aggressive and a little too direct. My very first opportunity to meet with a search committee placement process in one of our associations, the feedback that came to me the very next morning from a concerned pastor was, "You need to know, Karen, that your presence there last night was really on the aggressive side and was really not an appropriate style. And I'm concerned about you, so I wanted to call and let you know that so you can," the message was, "modify my behavior the next time." That same behavior, had it been on the part of a male area conference minister, would have been perceived very differently, because, in fact, the conference minister was with me at that meeting, and we talked about what happened. Those are some of the kinds of issues related to the gender stereotyping at the organizational level that impacts how we are in the church. Some of that sounds like pretty bad news. But the reality is there is good news out there as well, because for as many churches that are having closed doors, there are open doors. The difference is, and I say this whenever I talk to somebody about placement, you need to be willing to listen to the call of God wherever it might take you and however that might shape you. I have discovered that my call is not geographically limited, but I have to go where God calls me. And When I went to Florida, my Massachusetts friends said to me, "You must be absolutely out of your mind. Don't you know the conference minister down in Florida really doesn't like women?" When I went to Florida, there were three other women in the entire state serving churches, only one of whom was sole pastor. When I left, there were 14. We broke through the token status into minority level. When I left Florida to come to Pennsylvania, they said, "You really want to go to Pennsylvania? Don't you know that that's the hotbed of conservatism in our denomination?" The good news is I have been received warmly and with open arms, and that as you are centered in who you are in ministry and have a clear understanding of God in relationship to your life, then I think it's possible to minister under any circumstances. Thank you for letting me be here.
Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here this evening as well. I bring to this party this evening the concrete perspective, if you will. Yeah, not quite stained glass, but concrete. I would like to comment on a number of the things that were said this evening, and as I heard our speaker talking, it just brought back such realities for me and things that I had experienced. And unfortunately, things I don't see as much change in as I would hope to see, although I think the statistics do reflect that things are getting better. Interestingly, I tape occasionally the Oprah Winfrey Show, and for those who may have seen her show, I think it was either yesterday or day before yesterday, it was on students who, in their classroom experience, observed how differently the teachers were treating them, where the male students were, in, if you will, given a lot of positive stroking, and the female students were ignored, where the male students were encouraged to be all that they could be, if you will, and the female students were not. And I think that moves forward not just from the elementary and high school level, but is also prevalent a lot in the professional schools, even though things are changing. With the numbers getting greater in law school, again, we weren't encouraged to go into what have traditionally been the more aggressive fields of law, such as litigation, but instead were pointed toward domestic relations and family law and labor law. And even though our numbers are increasing, we're still not seeing a lot of change. Again, even as I think of attorneys graduating from law schools, in terms of going with law firms, you don't have as many women being hired by law firms as you see women going into fields such as legal aid, where we may use that nurturing spirit, if you will, our continuous care for humanity. We're just not being pushed and motivated in those kinds of directions. I thought, as you commented about people hiring people who look like themselves, and if you'll forgive me the personal references, but I remember when I graduated law school, one of the jobs I interviewed for was with a bank, and they took me as a part of the interview out to show me the floor where I might be working if, in fact, they made me an offer. And I scanned the room and observed that the majority of people there were at least 5'10" in height, slender in build, most of whom were wearing either gray suits or navy suits, and looked down at my, at that point in time, red suit and kind of decided I wasn't going to fit in. And yet they say things are changing. I look at the comments with respect to, looking at my notes here, assignments of jobs and tasks. And in fact, there is a lot of reality that, to that in terms of moving up in an organization, being able to penetrate that glass ceiling, if you will. if, in fact, the nature of the assignments that you've been given don't show that you have the capacity to be able to handle the greater challenges, then when the decisions are made as to who gets promoted and who doesn't, those who have not had the responsibilities that suggest they can carry the greater barriers do not, in fact, get the opportunities for those promotions. Without picking on Fort New Holland, where I worked, and Fort New Holland was very, very good to me. But I think of a supervisor I had along the way, and my plate was always full with challenging assignments. But I can remember one of the gentlemen that I worked with just always seemed to be getting the flow of the better assignments. And I went to my supervisor and we talked about it. And his response was, well, Madeline, you're just so busy, you know, that you can't take that trip to Europe and you can't, you know, you know. And I said, well, you have the capacity to make me less busy so that I might be available to take that trip. But when it came time for the promotions, they looked down at his resume and said, well, he's had that international experience. So therefore, because he has had the broader opportunities, he is therefore better qualified to make the move up, which I could not argue because, in fact, he was. But again, if you don't open that door at the bottom with the assignment, you don't get that opportunity. I have a favorite story that I like to tell, and those who've heard me before I hope will bear with me, but I talk in terms of how assignments are constantly changing. It was not my aspiration to be an attorney. It was my aspiration to be a labor negotiator. I kind of envisioned that, you know, President Clinton would call and say, Madeline, we're having a problem. Could you help us out? And as I graduated from college, I went to the interviews, and the recruiters, who happened to all be male, white males, as a matter of fact, said to me, what is your background? And at that particular time, it was political science and English. And the recruiter said to me, gee, Madeline, you know, it has been our experience that those with a law degree make a better negotiator. We really wish you had one. We need someone with an understanding of the legal process. And so I went to the dean of my school and said, gee, I've got a real big problem because I've got to get into law school. And actually, I've got two problems because I've got to find someone else to pay for it. And I lucked up and I got into law school. I studied general trial practice and labor relations. And then I got ready to go back to the interviews. And the recruiter said to me at that point in time, well, Madeline, what's your background? And I said, well, it's political science and English. And he's starting to shake his head, and I said, but that's okay because I have a law degree. And he looked at me and said, you know, Madeline, in the 3 years that you were in law school, we discovered that people with a background in business administration make better negotiators. We need someone with an understanding of the bottom line. And I went back to the dean and said, you're not going to believe this. I've now got to get into business school. And I lucked up and got into Fordham University and got an MBA and went back to the interviews. And by that time, and I'm still wanting to be in the field of labor negotiations. And the individual said to me, well, Madeline, what's your background? And I said, you know, political science and English. And he's shaking his head. And I said, but that's okay. I have a law degree. And he's still shaking his head. And I said, but, you know, I've got you covered because I have a master's in business administration. And he stopped shaking his head. And by that time, I'm picking out the color of my Mercedes and planning my trips to Aruba. And he said, you know, Madeline, we'd love to hire you, but you're overqualified. And so I say that to say that the criteria for success is constantly changing, and the preparation that you think you've gone through to get you to the next level may or may not prepare you for that next level. And what you have to have, I believe, is a confidence within yourself that whatever the challenge might be, that you can make it to the next level. I think we as parents, and I have a 10-year-old daughter, and I am constantly trying to provide for her the fact that what she aspires to and what she is capable of doing comes from within, to use your phrase, that we must constantly work on improving our self-image and our self-esteem so that when someone says to you, you cannot do it, or there are reasons why you can't move to that next level, that you have the inner strength to move on. That we as parents need to be saying both to our boys as well as our girls, that times are changing and that our children are going to have to be prepared, as our speaker points out, to be the recruiters of the future, and that they are going to have to be in a position to make those kinds of decisions. The other thing I see and would like to comment about is the litigation side of it. There are lawsuits out there, but the average individual, when they feel that they have been discriminated against, will go to the ladies' room, if you will, and will complain to our peers. But when it comes time to go through that exit interview, we will not comment because we don't want to cloud that next opportunity. So rather than saying, I have met a barrier, I am leaving because I cannot make progress within your company, we tend to just say, it's been a wonderful experience, but I have a new opportunity and I'm moving on. But we don't leave the comments behind that allow our companies to improve. We don't pursue litigation because we don't want a reputation for the next employer of being too aggressive, of being someone who's a troublemaker. So while there are lawsuits out there, and the Marriott Corporation being one of them, there are just not enough of them. I'd like to leave time for questions from the audience, so I'll quit at that point.
Now it's your chance. It's open for you to ask questions. Please come to the microphone in the middle, and I would like to just let you know that we have about 10 minutes or so for you to ask your questions. And in doing that, please be sensitive to the fact that you're probably not the only one that has a question tonight. Yes, sir.
I will try to be sensitive to that. And I hope that this doesn't sound too much more like a comment than a question. But the first thing I'd like to say is that one, in the Ms. Austin's discussion as to categories, which I don't dispute the figures here, I'm also wondering what percentage of women are disabled persons and what percentage of women are disabled persons who are employed? I suppose that's my question, but as far as my comments go, I would say that I think the glass ceiling metaphor is a particularly potent one. And yet I think that what's needed, my comment is that what's needed, I think, is a sensitivity to what the true glass ceiling is. For instance, if I may use an example, my sister Noelle, who designed the Swiss Army watch, she went through the glass ceiling in December. She went through the windshield of her car in an accident. But that wasn't the glass ceiling that she went through. The glass ceiling that she went to was that she went to her judgment. And that was the point, that her service, one of the statements made was, there is a judgment. And that is what we need to be concerned about, not so much our careers.
So your concern for Dr. Oster, though, your question to her is about the question of people, women with disabilities,
yeah,
that you would like for her to respond to that.
That is the question.
Respond to that piece, and then we can open that up for another question.
I don't know what the percent of disabled women
are in the workforce. I don't know what percent who wish to be employed or are not, but the one thing I will say is given that some of the things I've talked about have to do with otherness, that there are glass ceilings for people who, of the other sex, the other race, the other ethnicity, the other age, I think you could certainly easily, even in terms of Rosabeth Cantor's example, put disabled in the category of otherness in terms of people having stereotypes and having it negatively bias others' reactions in the workforce. Much of what I said, you could put disabled into much of what I said about women.
Okay, I have one more question, and that is that, well, I'm not going to try to be a literalist here and point out examples from the Garden of Eden or point out something from 1 Timothy 2 where Paul inveighs against women speaking in church. But I am going to say that once again, there's that old idea of the through the glass darkly. That's what we're looking towards. And I personally don't believe that the role of the Christian church is to take up every cause of every mass minority or mass minority extortion group and make it its own. For example, I'm a graduate of the institution you teach at. I graduated in 1981. But I'm a grand mal epileptic. Do you know that I have never had a job in my life excepting the 7 years I drove a taxi cab and had to lie about being an epileptic to get it? And that is the case with many disabled people all across this country. They have to conceal it or else they don't work. There are laws out there. Sure, a few years ago, I asked our inspector directly, face to face, what are you going to do for these people in these wheelchairs? He said, well, I think you better ask the city fathers about that. Well, of course, it's now the city mothers, but the problem is it's the same thing.
Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Disabled people are tired of being swept under the carpet, male or female.
I think you'd have a lot of affirmation on that comment. Any other questions? Yes, please go to the microphone. You may want to move so that you're able to get to the microphone after this next question so that your travel time is shortened. Go ahead. Run.
I'm short, too.
I can relate to that.
I'd like to ask the panel if they feel that women are the women's worst enemy. I have a story to tell about some experiences of my own plus someone else. But this reflects the fact that women often don't encourage other women to proceed up the ladder or to make decisions. I think most of it's jealousy, I think, my own experience. But I have a story to tell about the first female surgeon in Lancaster whom I asked to do surgery for me because she was a woman. And when I asked her if anybody, especially male, had ever turned down her services because she was a woman, she said, no males ever had. I once had a patient who needed a hernia operation, and he was satisfied with my technique, but his wife wouldn't let me operate on him. I'm wondering if women, again, are their own worst enemy.
Do you want to direct that to any specific person or anyone who's willing
anyone
to take
the
mic?
Anyone on the panel.
Okay.
I heard, go for it. There are occasions when I believe that we as women tend not to be as supportive of each other as we could be. I would like to think that that is changing, that as we see the progress of others, we are encouraged to believe that if she can do it, I can do it. So I'd like to think it's changing, but it does exist.
I just want to respond in relationship to that mysterious placement process. Often I hear from search committees who say, well, it is the women in the church who don't want us to consider a woman. You know, and it's those people out there when, in fact, oftentimes, particularly the older women. I mean, not only does it become women, it becomes an ageist issue. It's only the older women who don't really want it. In relationship to placement issues, it's often folks between 30 and 55 who are in the midst of conserving their career, building their family, who are most uncomfortable with change in some ways, and younger folk and older folk are far more flexible and open sometimes.
Hi, I really enjoyed your feedback on this issue. I work with a women's group, and I'm also a single parent of three small children. And because I work with women's issues, I find that they're not very high-paying jobs. And I constantly struggle with trying to make ends meet and be home with my kids. And I pretty much have accepted the fact that I'll probably have to go back to school. I presently have a bachelor's with 1 year towards my master's, which doesn't do very much. But and I'm very concerned because I believe in nurturing children and being there, and I don't want, you know, I don't believe in, I've hardly ever used a babysitter apart from childcare to go to work. But I constantly hear about, if I'm going to go back to school, would it be better when they're young, or should I wait till they're older? Because I find it's getting harder the older they get. And if I do choose to go back to school, what fields, in your opinion, are better for women and help with higher incomes? Because, you know, three children, no child support, of course. And it's just very difficult to be there. I'm involved with women's issues. I believe in empowering women. I just find that I'm not the only one. I mean, all my friends, everybody I work with are pretty much just struggling just to make ends meet and raise these children at the same time. But I don't know where to head from here, you know, as opposed to quit everything and go back to mom's house. And, of course, I have no extended family in Pennsylvania. You know, I just, you know, and I find that a lot of women are stuck at the same level. It's either work very hard, raise your kids by yourself, and be maybe $29 above the poverty level, go back to school, and if so, what do you study, what do you do to improve the situation in the short run, really? You know, well, in the long run, but quick enough to be there for your kids nonetheless.
I think you can only decide what to go to school in based on your own interests. Mm-hmm. I mean, you need to find something that works for you, clicks for you. In religion, of course, you talk about it as a call, but I think even to my profession, although it doesn't have a religious ring to it, I felt as though it's what I should do. I think if you're concerned about, you know, how much time you spend with your children or not, children thrive well in nurturing environments, and it may be that it doesn't have to be you who is there all the time. I mean, there are lots of children in lots of different situations. What they need is a safe, nurturing, a place where they can learn and grow environment, and maybe thinking harder about that may help you feel freer to pursue what you want to pursue sooner. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that this is biased by, you know, what I'm doing with my life and what I'm doing with my young children, but there are times where I feel where if I can't be with them, what I can do is be a good resource person and have someone with them who I am glad is with them. Mm-hmm. They both go to a daycare center, but there are certainly other moments where my husband and I want to do other things. Mm-hmm. And they actually like all these people that, I mean, we don't say, there's someone coming to babysit for 3 hours. We say, you know, Amy's coming to play with you tonight. And, I mean, I would describe them as thrilled when the person walks in the door. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe feeling as though you can find either locations or people that are nurturing of your children, you won't feel as compelled that you have to be the one who's there if you have these other things that you want to do now.
I also think that's a real big issue with women who are barely making and barely raising the family. The idea of paying a child is, you know, virtually impossible. If I can do it once a month, it's fine. And see, I'm okay with that, but I find there are a lot of women just don't have the resources, and the extended family is not as available as it once was, I don't think.
What you may want to consider is once you've found your focus in terms of what you want to do, is getting with other women who are pursuing the same avenues you do, so that maybe they will keep your child gratis, no fee, while and you are willing to take care of their child when they have that need. So it's kind of a bartering type situation where you're not actually paying for child care.
I'm starting to believe in communes, you know. I'm starting to sound good to me.
You're the lucky winner of the last question. Yes, ma'am. So it better be a good one.
Oh, I know.
And short.
Well, first of all, I'd like to applaud the gentleman on the panel. You are truly, in many of our eyes, a man of the 90s, and we need more of you running our companies who can help create those types of environments. I work for a Fortune 10 company. I think I'm one of those women aspiring to be an executive, if you will. I also have three children under three. So I have a very demanding. I had twins last year, so that I tell my manager.
You can't send one back, can you?
I told my boss I have a habit of exceeding my objectives, and truly, in that case, I did. In any case, one of the things that we say in my company is that the environment for women in corporations will not change until the men who are running our companies have daughters who are faced with these issues. And that is just starting to happen, as their true daughters who want to make it are forcing the struggles, and then they're starting to come around. In any case, without further ado, my question is in the area of balancing your work and family. I'd like to address this to Carol. It's not in your statistics, but I'm familiar that of the women who make it to the upper echelon, if you will, and we know there are less than 4% or something now, very few of those have children, which means that they have had to sacrifice probably some personal values to make it. And one of the things that I've seen is that the glass ceiling in many corporations and probably any organization is in direct correlation with the child rearing age, that whether you like it or not, your superiors place you in on the mommy track, for some people call it that, or in the fact that, well, obviously her priorities are going to be different. She's got three children at home. How could she be possibly as dedicated to her career? And I'd just like your comments on, based on things you've seen, how much is the glass ceiling in direct correlation with the fact that women have, at that age, maybe 8 to 10 years in their career, made the decision to have children and balance their lives, if you will?
I don't know that I can give a direct answer. I think part of what goes on is, I mean, if a woman still wants to spend the same number of hours she had spent before in her career, then one would hope that whoever is the manager, the supervisor, would see that. I think it's often the case that women shift gears some on their own, at least for a few years, and maybe what the supervisor or manager has to understand is that that's also going to shift back again. That may be difficult to explain. I think another thing is that there are many men who wish they could step back a little bit. And I'm not trying to talk out of both sides of my mouth here, but I think on the one hand, there are many parents who simply don't want to put forth the same effort to careers at particular moments as they do family, which really points to the larger issue, I think, that we are paying too much attention to work. We say we are successful only if we are successful at our work, and I think society has done that to both men and women. And I think, I don't know how you do this, I think if values could be shifted dramatically to actually accord as much prestige to that which goes on in the family, that families would be stronger, that men would feel more comfortable spending more time with families, women would feel more comfortable shifting gears back and forth, men might feel more comfortable. And most people I know, even if they love their jobs, say they wish that their job was about two-thirds of what it actually, the amount of time it takes up. And if you imagined our society with each person who's a full-time working doing two-thirds of their job, imagine how much more time for both men and women to nurture their family, their friends, or whatever. You know, what do you actually do? I don't know. If you want to stay on a fast track, it means that a man or a woman still has to put forth the same number of hours. Otherwise, you need to be explaining why you're stepping back for a moment, but, you know, you'll be back in a year or 2 years or 3 years or whatever.